This session is entitled Pilgrimage and Dialogue with Other Religions. It really should be with people of other religions, but there's not enough room on the title to put it that way. I mean, obviously you can't dialogue with other religions, you dialogue with people. But I assume that everyone understands that. This is a session in an overall series that I'm giving. I was here last week, and then this week also, on the encounter between Christianity, or between Christians and people of other religions in the world. And the overall series I've called something like Exploring the Many Tongues, you know, based on the fact that this is Pentecost week. Yesterday we celebrated Pentecost, and this is the festival of the giving of the Spirit to the disciples when they had the gift of speaking in tongues, so that pilgrims from all over the world could understand in their own languages. And my idea in this series is to suggest that perhaps in these days we need to hear those many tongues from those other people and start to understand them better and to learn some things from them. This fits in well, as I've said before, with the theme of Holden Village this summer, a whole new world, participating in healing the wounds and the fractures of our world and making it whole once again, in many ways, the environment, the racial problems, gender issues, but also recognizing that the religions of the world, particularly including Christianity, have had a major role to play in fracturing the world in many ways in the past. And so trying to explore ways in which we as Christians can begin to understand people from other religions and perhaps work together toward a whole new world. The theme, of course, is chosen in keeping with the 500th anniversary of the discovery of America by Europeans, the coming of Europeans and the beginning of this new world, which was also the subjugation and destruction of the world that was here, namely the Native Americans and their religion and culture. And I pointed out last week that 1492 was also the year in which a great symbolic event occurred in Europe. That was the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. Of course, the Jews had been expelled from many countries, but this was sort of the crowning blow of the massive expulsion of Jewish people from Christian Spain. And that has come to symbolize the Christian relationship to Jewish people, and of course to many of the other religions of the world. So my attempt in this little series is to help us as Christians to think about new possibilities, new ways that we can take a look at ourselves, perhaps rethink some of our own ideas, and explore possibilities of understanding people of other religions, learning from them, and perhaps cooperating with them. It was Pentecost yesterday, and that sort of, as I said, set the theme for this little series on Christianity and world religions. The many tongues represented there at Pentecost. But we should also remember that Pentecost was, first of all, a Jewish festival. Right? The Feast of Weeks, it was called. Festival when Jewish people came from all over the world as pilgrims to Jerusalem, one of the three great pilgrimage festivals among the Jews, the other being Passover and Unleavened Bread, and Sukkot, or the Feast of Booths in the fall. So this was a pilgrimage festival that was Pentecost. It was called Pentecost in Greece, and it was at that point when the disciples were gathered together that the birth of the Christian church took place. But for Jews, Shavuot, or Feast of Weeks, is a very important festival still today. It's the festival in which they commemorate the giving of the covenant, in particular, and the giving of the law at Mount Sinai, and thus, in many respects, the birth of the Jewish people, right? And in Jewish thinking, the giving of the law to Israel and the making of the covenant is really intended for all peoples. Now, all peoples weren't able to accept the Torah and enter into the covenant, but the Jewish people chose to do that as representative of all people, right? And then I pointed out also last week, and I'll repeat that again since I don't think many of you were here the first day last week. This is another great festival, this whole week, in fact, for Muslims. This is the pilgrimage, the Hajj. Maybe we should write this up. For Jews, it is Shavuot. And for Muslims, it is the Hajj, or pilgrimage, which actually is a two-week-long affair, more or less. It started last week already with Muslim pilgrims arriving in Mecca to perform the early rituals of the pilgrimage in Mecca. And then approximately yesterday, I don't know for sure since I haven't seen the newspaper, but approximately yesterday was the standing on Mount Arafat, which is the high point of the pilgrimage, when all of the pilgrims gather together, all 2 or 3 million of them, and spend a whole day standing out in the plain of Arafat and the Mountain of Mercy, praying to the one God, representing the whole human race, gathered together from all nations and language groups and so forth, coming together as one human community. And that also just took place, or maybe it's taking place right now, I don't know. And then the pilgrimage will continue the rest of this week until about Friday, when they have the Feast of Sacrifice. And that sort of begins to end the pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm. So the Shavuot is a set amount of time after Passover, right? Just like the Pentecost is a certain amount of time.
Right. 5 weeks after the waving of the sheaves during the Festival of Unleavened Bread, which is during the Passover.
Okay, so the Muslim, is it also always, do they always coincide?
No, they don't. The Muslim calendar is the lunar calendar, which actually the Jewish calendar was originally also. Mm-hmm. And it's set in a certain month of the year, pilgrimage month. But since the Muslim year is about 13 days shorter than our solar calendar, that means every year the pilgrimage month changes just a little bit. It gets a little bit earlier in the year. Right? Okay. Next year it'll be about 2 weeks earlier, right, and so forth. So it doesn't have any reference any longer to... it just happens that it's the same day. It's almost fortuitous, right? Probably, I shouldn't say, but you know, it's been many, many years since this coincidence occurred before. So maybe we should take note of it. Three great festivals in these three great religions coming together, and all of them having some kind of implication for the whole human community, right? Pentecost and Shavuot, and particularly the pilgrimage. So, and then we should throw in, of course, that yesterday was also Chief Seattle Day. The attempt in the Lutheran Church to honor and pay attention to an important Native American leader, Chief Seattle, who said some important things about Native American culture. Either he said them, or you know, sometimes other things were written by other people and attributed to him. But certainly he is a worthy figure to honor as representative of the voices of Native Americans to us. So all of these kind of come together. Therefore, this week, what I'm going to focus on tomorrow will be looking specifically at Native American spirituality, and then. Wednesday we won't have a session, but Thursday will be a quick look at the Jewish path, our older siblings, the Jews, and you know, kind of opening a door a little bit to begin to listen to Jewish voices. And then Friday and Saturday both will be looking at Muslims, particularly since that's just the ending of the pilgrimage. It works out nicely. But I thought today we would maybe spend our time talking in a little bit of a preliminary way about the whole topic of Christian encounter with people of other religions, the possibility of learning from them, of perhaps even drawing something from them, and what kind of attitudes are necessary in order to do that. So, just like last week, Monday, so today I want to make this a little more general discussion without getting into the specifics of some of the different religions, particularly unless you want to. You know, like we've already mentioned some specifics up here. I thought maybe the image or the metaphor or whatever you call it of pilgrimage would be a useful thing to think about. Last week, I kept talking a lot about Christian presence, being present to people of other religion, and the fact that that meant particularly listening to them, you know, not just talking to them, but also listening to them. Maybe the metaphor that we could use this week and keep coming back to would be that of pilgrimage, being on a pilgrimage. Because these are pilgrimage festivals, right? Both the Jewish Feast of Weeks and the Muslim Hajj are pilgrimage events. And if we take a look at Christian tradition and biblical tradition, the notion of being pilgrims is pretty authentic, right? You find it all through the Bible, particularly in the Jewish scriptures and then also in the New Testament, in Hebrews 11 and in other places, that image is used, that the people of God are a pilgrim people, you know, on a pilgrimage. Now, what does that mean? I think metaphors are important for understanding ourselves because we draw from them, you know, and we derive our identity from the way we image things. What are some of the alternatives that have been used widely in the history of the Christian church to try and define the identity of the Christian church? Now, I'm suggesting let's think a little bit about being a pilgrim people. What are some of the other ones that have been used? Other images and metaphors or whatever you want to call it.
About the Crusades.
Okay. The Crusaders, right? That would be a metaphor. Maybe, and it wasn't really just a metaphor. It was real at one time. But then it becomes an image that's taken over. You know, we are on a crusade for Christ, right?
Missionary work?
Yeah, missionary work, although that's not so much an image as, you know, sort of a working out of a basic sense of calling. But if missionaries are thought to be the crusaders out there, right, then that becomes more of an image or metaphor.
How about the saving here? You know, it's almost more than the crusades. It's kind of on the missionary. In other words, they're just lost out there until you get there and help them.
Okay, the image of the lost out there and the saviors coming in to save them.
Yeah, you got to work through.
The ambassadors.
Ambassadors is another kind of image, drawn more from the political realm. There is the Lord or the ruler, and we are the ambassadors. I guess the one that contrasts most starkly with the idea of pilgrims, and the one that I think has been used a lot in the history of the church, is that of the conquerors. It fits kind of with the Crusades. And what is that hymn that a lot of people like so much?
Onward
Christian soldiers, marching as to war, with the cross of Jesus going on before. And then, obviously, then we're going out to conquer somebody, right? Now, that is a very different image from that of pilgrim people, right? And then, a very biblical metaphor, but one that also is very problematic to a lot of us, is the kingdom, right? The kingdom of God, or the kingdom of David, or whatever. The notion of establishing a kingdom with a ruler and subjects. Now, all of those metaphors involve either conquest or involve the idea that we have everything, right? You set up a kingdom, and when you have a kingdom, you build the Great Wall, right? When China became a kingdom, unified for the first time, the first thing that the Qing leaders did was to build the Great Wall of China. Or you make a fortress. So you wall out the enemies, and you establish and maintain yourself. You plant yourself solidly, and you defy the rest of the world, or you conquer the rest of the world, or whatever. Now, admittedly, I'm giving the bad parts of some of those images. That there are also helpful and useful things to draw from them, and Christians certainly have. But maybe it's time to think of new images and metaphors, and a thoroughly biblical one is the idea of being on a pilgrimage, the pilgrim people of God. Well, what does that mean? What is a pilgrimage, or the notion of being pilgrims? Anybody flesh that out a little bit from your own sense of how that's used in Christian history?
Well, I was thinking about in terms of the Muslims.
Okay, we'll start with that.
I get the notion that it's some sort of like honoring or homage paying to God, you know, to show your dedication, your devotion, your faith, it's mm-hmm. a witnessing kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. It's a witnessing thing. Yeah, it's honoring God. It's fulfilling an obligation for Muslims. One of the five basic obligations. It means a trip, right? It means for Muslims. It means maybe saving their money for 20 years so that they can finally make this pilgrimage to Mecca, which will be the high point of their lives. What happens on a pilgrimage? I guess that's one of the things I'm thinking about a little bit.
You're on a journey, so you move towards a destination. Mm-hmm. It's a process.
Mm-hmm.
It opens it up along the way.
It's something open-ended in a way. It's a journey. It has unknowns in it, right? It's not this solid kingdom where you can build your walls and you feel safe and secure, but you put yourself at risk, right? You go on a pilgrimage not knowing for sure if you're going to come back.
About all the Christian or religious aspects of the world, it seems like everybody has the monastery type movement into something, then out of that comes something else, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly how to say that, but mm-hmm. monasteries, they go in there for various and sundry reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the religion, they come out with different information than they go in with.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. A monastery is also a passage, right? It involves an initiation, a period of training, and a change, right? And you come out something different. And in a way, that's what pilgrimage is. It's a time of transition. It's a journey. It's a way. It's a search, a quest. We can use all of those kinds of terms. And all of them are a little bit open-ended, right? You journey onward, like Abraham. The book of Hebrews talks about Abraham as a pilgrim, leaving his land behind and journeying onward, not knowing what this was, but going by faith, right? So it's on the way type of theology. Pilgrimage is what we sometimes might refer to as a liminal experience. Now, that's a hard word. I don't know if we need to use it or not. But it's a handy word because liminal refers to a kind of a threshold experience where you leave something behind, you die to something, and you're not yet sure where it is that you're going. You are in this sort of in-between experience. It's a journey, right? And in that kind of a liminal period, there's opportunity for transformation to occur. You can learn new things. You can be open to new experiences. There's a risk involved because you don't know for sure where it's going to come out. And yet you have hope and faith and so forth. So I think all of those kinds of images can feed into
and a kind of approach where the next step will be now to relate this to some of the other religions of the world. Kathy?
Do these people on pilgrimage, Christians if you will, take a culture with them as they're going on this pilgrimage? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you always have to take your culture with you. I mean, you can't just be a person completely divorced from your culture. But part of the notion of being on a pilgrimage is that a transformation is going to take place. You know, if you're just totally set in your culture and happy with that and don't need any changing, why go on a pilgrimage, right?
Look at what Columbus did. Mm-hmm. He brought the Catholic Church to the Western Hemisphere.
I wouldn't call that a pilgrimage, though.
Well, I mean, well...
But that's true. He brought the culture along with him, and it was changed in the process.
Well, that's right.
It was changed in the process.
And there's also that element of faith in that. I mean, they know not where they're going, but they know they're being guided towards the destination.
Yeah, there's a certain confidence involved, and an excitement, a discovery. And maybe a rediscovery. I mean, maybe it's on pilgrimage that you really find out who you are, right? And so forth. So it's a learning, growing, transforming experience.
In the Christian concept of this, this is, are you saying this is a continual, ongoing sort of thing, as opposed to my understanding of the Hajj is that once you have all of your temporal things taken care of, you know, your family is grown, all of your responsibilities to this world are fulfilled in one form or another, now is the time then to make this commitment to Allah. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a secondary thing. Now, is Christianity a continual, ongoing pilgrimage, or is it one where... I suppose that some people would come here to Holden and say, well, it's, I decide now that I am going to get in touch more with my spiritual side. Mm-hmm. Is it ongoing versus a step function?
What do you think?
Well, I'd like to have it ongoing.
Okay. No, certainly it's ongoing. And the same would be true for Muslims. I think you're right in that for many Muslims it is kind of a culminating experience to go on the Hajj. Although that, I mean, that's not necessarily true. A lot of young people go, and go many, many times, right? Mm-hmm. But the image of as you say, having everything in order, you're not supposed to have any debts, you know, and so forth, and make the Hajj sort of the culmination of your life, is true. And yet, Muslims point out that what happens in the Hajj is kind of a recapitulation of the whole path. I mean, Islam is called the path, the straight path. So a Muslim is always on a pilgrimage. And when a Muslim dies, she is dressed in pilgrimage garment and placed in the grave facing Mecca. So even death is a pilgrimage, right? So what happens in Mecca on the Hajj is just sort of a encapsulation, a symbolization of the whole path. And certainly that's what I would think of this image meaning for Christians, that all of life is a path. And I'm just suggesting if we use a metaphor like pilgrimage, being pilgrims, it might help give us some new handles and some new ideas, rather than using something like Kingdom of God or the Conquering Army or you know, a whole variety of other images that could be used.
Mm-hmm. Could you give me some assurance that in our own land, Christians in general are moving on a pilgrimage? And if so, is it a Christian pilgrimage or is it more denominational?
Mm-hmm. Two very good questions that no, I can't give you the assurance, but I think there are certainly Christians who understand their Christianity in the way that I'm talking of it here as a pilgrimage. And it's not denominational. It's something certainly greater than that. But no, I can't give that assurance, I don't think.
I'm just afraid that in our mainline churches, it's something less than that for the vast majority.
Right. And you generally don't here, I shouldn't say that because I haven't really looked carefully, but you don't generally don't hear that kind of encouragement from established churches, because, you know, people on pilgrimage are a little bit, you can't count on them completely, right? Maybe not count on them for a lot of contributions and so forth. So we should, of course, recognize that there may be negative aspects to any metaphor, and pilgrimage too. You know, you can think of pilgrims as just sort of passing through and not really getting in touch with the earth right here, right? If you're always just passing through, that may not be exactly the right kind of image for Christians either. I mean, maybe we do need to really be in touch with Mother Earth right here and not always just be pilgrims on the way. But we need to recognize that any metaphor or any image only has some aspects of it that are really helpful. And if you push it to other aspects, you can get to negative things. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Except coming for hold, do Christians really have a place, one specific spot where they all want to do a pilgrimage? We don't, do we?
Yeah. Well,
Catholics like to go to Rome.
Catholics can go to Rome. Lutherans can. Where do Lutherans go?
Minneapolis,
was it? No, I thought it was Chicago. Or St. Louis. Or Wittenberg. Obviously, we're not talking pilgrimage so much in a geographical sense, although that's always real. I mean, a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, to the Holy Land. But we're talking more about life as a pilgrimage. And what happens on pilgrimages? Maybe we Christians don't understand that too much, because pilgrimage as such is not something that is built into Christianity very much, except, as you mentioned, like going to Rome or to Minneapolis or to Holden.
Catholics also go to Lourdes and
yeah, France. Right. There are some real pilgrimages. But if you look at some of the other religions, like Hinduism, which has a lot of pilgrimage activity, and even Islam and some of the other religions, pilgrimage is a different kind of time from their ordinary time. I call it a liminal time. In many of these societies, like Hindu society, let's just use that as an example, there are some very sharp divisions. You know, we know the caste system of India, or the class system, and all of these subcastes. And there are actually different, what we would think of almost as different religions within Hinduism. There are worshippers of Vishnu and worshippers of Shiva and so forth. And they tend to be pretty separate. But on a pilgrimage, those divisions generally kind of fade away. And a new kind of community is created without those barriers and divisions of caste and different sex and so forth. And that's another thing that I think is important about the image of pilgrimage, and that's really what I want to get into a little bit more now, is the possibility of thinking of this pilgrimage that we're on as not just a Christian pilgrimage, you know, as one stream here, one path, but in a broader sense, a global pilgrimage in which there are other paths, other religious paths, fellow pilgrims, the Jewish people, certainly, and the Muslims, and the Native Americans. And last week we were talking about Hindus and Buddhists, and even some of the Chinese religions, as fellow pilgrims, right? And then that notion of pilgrimage as being the possibility of breaking down some of the divisions. You know, when you're walking on the way with people, and you got a long way to walk in India, days and days, and you camp together at night and so forth, you start telling each other stories. And you start hearing other people's stories. And once you tell each other your stories, then it's kind of hard, once again, to erect these walls between you. You share something of yourself with these fellow pilgrims over here on this other path, and they share something with you. And, then there's a learning process, an understanding process, and a growing process. So I guess that's what interests me right now about this pilgrimage metaphor, is that
If we can start thinking perhaps of people of other religious paths as fellow pilgrims in one way or another, then perhaps common problems, common goals, the need to heal this broken world, to create peace, to save the environment and so forth, and share our stories about that and develop some kind of cooperation and community that will help us reach some of those goals. Now, of course, all of that presupposes, certain theological attitudes, right? In order for something like that to happen, or for us to be able to buy into that, we first of all have to start with respect for these other religious paths, right? And some kind of a theology that would at least permit us to listen to them and to hear them and to learn from them. Now, as we all know, and we talked about this last week, so I don't want to go back into that, but in the general history of the Christian Church, the attitude toward people of other religions has been very negative. I don't think we need to elaborate on that very much. It's been very much we have the truth, everything else, therefore, must be false. We are the pilgrims, the conquering pilgrims, if that kind of a contradiction can be used. And the goal is to convert all the people of the world, displace all of the other religions, and have everybody marching in the Christian army. And then I guess it wouldn't be an army any longer, because there wouldn't be anybody left to conquer. But anyway, that general attitude of a negative judgment on people of other religions has been pretty widespread. Not exclusively. I mean, we talked last time about some other attitudes. But what I'm suggesting here does presuppose that we rethink our theology a bit too, and see what there is in our Christian theological resources that would help us develop respect for people of other religions and thus begin thinking of them more as fellow pilgrims. And I suggest that there are some important Christian theological resources. And let me run through just a few of them, and then let's stop and get some reactions to you on this particular topic. And then, in the rest of the time, I would like to talk a little bit about what it means to be talking to people of other religions. And that's where the dialogue part of that topic for today comes in. Pilgrimage and dialogue with people of other religions. What does it mean to enter into some kind of conversation or dialogue with these other pilgrims? But first, let's talk about what theological resources are there that we can draw on to encourage us to think more positively, or at least more respectfully of people of other religions. And I'll just list three of them, and we can do that in a very easy way. Let's make it a trinity, right? First of all, the doctrine of creation, or God the Creator, is, I think, a very important resource that we have to keep going back to. What does it mean that Christians confess, I believe in God the Creator? We talked about this a little bit last time. It certainly means that God is the creator of all peoples of the world, right? And not just back at the beginning, but right now, this very instant, God stands in a creative relationship with all of the peoples of the world. She is present to everyone, right? The Creator, without exception. There is no person on the face of this earth who is not in a relationship with God the Creator. And that creative relationship means not only that God creates our bodies, God creates our minds, right? And our culture. The Bible suggests that God creates music. And God creates art. I mean, not directly, but God is the creative force so that humans produce music. And even wine, The Bible talks about God being the creator of wine. You know, so all of human culture. And that certainly means then also that part of human culture that we call religion is somehow or other connected with God. So, you know, I think just reflecting a little bit on the basic Christian doctrine of God as the creator would lead us to expect that somehow or other God is present for these people of other religions. You know, that doesn't mean that we know exactly how God is present to them, but at least we can be confident that as we tell stories with these other fellow pilgrims, we're going to find that God is there somehow or other. There's an important little section in the New Testament that I want to look at just briefly. I find it rather fascinating. It's that story in Acts chapter 17 about Paul on one of his missionary journeys, winding up in Athens at the Forum. And, you know, walking around and debating, it says he was arguing and dialoguing with the Jews in the synagogue. And then he went out and walked around and saw all of these statues to the gods. And remember that one that was dedicated to the unknown God. And, you know, then some of the philosophers gathered together to hear this fellow, what he would have to say. And what he said is very interesting. You know, you recall, I'm sure, a lot of you, that he said, you know, I've noticed that you have this unknown God statue here, or this altar to the unknown God. Well, I'm going to tell you about that unknown God. So he attaches onto something that they already have in mind. And then he says, I proclaim this God to you, the God who made the world and everything in it. The one who gives breath to all people, life and breath and everything. Right? So this God is the creator, the one who made all people and gives them life and breath and everything. And God made from one every nation of people to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their habitation. And this is the key passage that I want to emphasize. That they should seek God in the hope that they might feel after God and find God. That's quite a statement. Here Paul is speaking to these Greek philosophers and so forth, saying, I'm going to tell you about this unknown God, the God who made everybody, and he made everybody in order that they should seek after God, feel after God, and find God. There's a perhaps in there, but at least the idea is a rather striking one. And then he goes on, as if to punctuate that, to quote from a couple of the Greek poets. And he quotes approvingly from them, right? One of them he quotes, a Greek poet who wrote, in God we live and move and have our being. And another one had written, we are indeed God's offspring. And so Paul quotes from Greek pagan poets to illustrate his notion that God created people all over the world to seek after God and perhaps find God. That's interesting. Maybe we don't need to say too much more about it than just that it's interesting. But if we follow Paul's example and we start talking to our Muslim neighbors and Jewish neighbors and Buddhist neighbors, you know, we might expect to find that they also are seeking after God and perhaps finding God. Right? And maybe we can quote from some Muslim writings and we certainly quote from Jewish writings and perhaps even Buddhist writings like Paul did from Greek writings. Okay, so I think that's one resource that we can really make more use of than we have. The whole notion of God as the creator of everybody and many passages like this, and then there are others in the Bible. Now some people, of course, and Lutherans in particular, then stop at this point and say, we know that God is the creator of everybody, and we know that God then works through two kingdoms. Right? That's a good Lutheran way of thinking of the activity of God. Or another way of putting it is God works through law and gospel. And yes, God is in the creator relationship with all of these other people of the world, but that's a relationship of law, right? A relationship of law where their sinfulness is exposed and so forth. And God working in the gospel in the sense of saving people and healing people and working in grace and mercy is restricted to Christians. So that would be a typical Lutheran way to approach this reality, that God is the creator of everybody, but then we can divide it up in terms of law and gospel, or kingdom of the left hand, kingdom of the right hand. But I don't think that can be done. I don't think that's a proper theological approach to God as the creator. Because another basic Christian doctrine says that when God is active, it is the whole God. Not just a part of God, not just God the creator, but the entire God. You know, and here's where the idea of the Trinity comes in. Now, the Trinity doesn't mean that there are three gods, as we all know, you know, and God the Creator is here working among all these people of the world, and God the Redeemer is only working among Christians. Wherever God is active, it is the whole God. That means God the Creator, the Redeemer, and the Life Giver is present to all people. So here's where then the second resource would come in that we can do a lot more with, I think, the whole notion of the incarnation. And I'm going to make this rather brief so we can have some discussion and not run out of time. But what is the notion of the incarnation? It is that God became present in human flesh and human culture. And according to Christians, that presence focuses on Jesus Christ. But that presence certainly is not bound by the man Jesus, right, who lived and died many centuries ago. The doctrine of the incarnation in its broadest form, or what we call Christology, tells us that that Christ the Redeemer is pre-existent, was always God, right? And even after the lifetime of the man Jesus, Christ the Redeemer still is present in human flesh and culture. It's one of the things I remember from my seminary education that I puzzled with at the time, is that the incarnation, that is, God in human flesh, does not stop when Jesus dies and rises and ascends to heaven. But the incarnation is something that is always real. Here we can look at another Bible passage. The classic text for the incarnation would be John chapter 1. And that also is a very important resource for us to use as we think about this question for today. Many of you know how this gospel starts out with very important statement. In the beginning was the Word. In Greek, that's the Logos. This eternal Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. She was in the beginning with God. I guess we could use the word she, because this eternal Logos is beyond gender, right? So let's use she. All things were made through her. And without her was not anything made that was made. In her was life, and the life was the light of humans. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The true light that enlightens every human was coming into the world. All this tells about this eternal, universal Word of God. And then, of course, when you get to verse 14 there, it says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We could see him. Now this is Jesus, but you know that combination of this universal expression of God, then the incarnation into human form, I think gives us all kinds of things to think about with respect to the other peoples of the world. And you know, maybe I'll just leave it at that and let you think about it for a little while as to to what kinds of things might be drawn from that with respect to this question of people who are not Christian, you know, but who are on other religious paths. And then, of course, the third resource would be the whole Christian doctrine of the Spirit. It certainly is not an exclusive Christian possession. The Spirit gives life to all. One of my favorite stories in this connection comes up a little bit later in the book of Acts, after the Pentecost story, the story of Cornelius, who was a Roman centurion. Not a Jew, not a Christian, but a Roman centurion. But he's called a pious person who prayed to God. And God heard him, right? Not a Jew, not a Christian, but he prayed to God. And then the Spirit gave a vision to him, telling him to invite Peter. Peter was having a problem because Peter thought he could only associate with Jews and eat food that's properly prepared. And this was supposed to teach Peter that he could associate with Gentiles and eat any kind of food. And then at the end of that encounter, Peter finally came to understand, and he says in Acts chapter 10, Peter opened his mouth and said, "Truly I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him." So whatever that means, it means that the Spirit of God is active in this pagan, right, this Roman centurion. A revelation was given to him, and somehow or other this has a part in the story of the church. And so we could do a lot more then with the whole notion of the work of the Spirit. And there are certainly a lot of other Christian resources too, but those are just some basic ones that I want to point you to give a little backing for my suggestion that we can think respectfully and positively of people of other religions and think of them as fellow pilgrims. Talk with them, share with them, and learn from them. Okay, how about a little reaction from you on this notion of kind of rethinking Christian theology along these lines? Jenny?
Even though you can respectfully acknowledge a person of another religion as being a pilgrim, don't we as Christians, even in the most positive sense, have the commission to evangelize? Where does that come in? Even though personally I think it's obvious that there's much to learn from mm-hmm. all cultures. Mm-hmm. How do you handle that?
Well, maybe before I give you an answer, how about answers from some of the rest of you? I mean, I can easily give you some answers on that I think of, but how about some input from the rest of you? That's a very good question, and it's a basic question to Christian identity.
I think she's asked a very good question, because I think you evangelize more than you realize when you just sit and party with someone from another faith. You are in discussion, and when you're in discussion, you exchange ideas. It's the how to exchange ideas that's the important thing, but you really do evangelize in that way. Even when Christ talked to the Samaritan woman, for example, at the well, I'm impressed with that, because he never once told her that she had to do something. He just listened to her. He talked about her life. Actually, the decision that she made with her life thereafter was her own. Yes, influenced by their conversation. I don't really know the detail of what she had to say, but I just think he showed us a way to live his life and have someone look at our life and decide for themselves, instead of pushing this idea of damnation if you're not saved, that it's that I'm just the only one that's right. And you turn more people away when you actually take that kind of a pushy attitude. You really destroy the church more than you build the church.
Okay, so that it's a evangelism
can be done in a way that's not pushy, right? It's kind of what you're saying, yes. Following Jesus' model, yes, or the sharing that he did.
Yeah, picking up on that, because I, from your discussions last week and in reference to the question, at the beginning of last week, I sort of thought, well, what has become of this missionary zeal and all that, you know, rather than just... But it seems to me that within the Christian faith, that we would have, that we love unconditionally. Therefore, we visit, we talk, we mm-hmm. share, we listen, mm-hmm. we expect, we even give of what we think. Mm-hmm. But we don't expect any return, mm-hmm. necessarily. And we don't expect, and we certainly don't judge mm-hmm. that they're going to hell or someplace mm-hmm. bad. Mm-hmm. And that would be the way to do it.
Yeah.
In other words, we're just sharing this. Yes. We're just sharing this unconditionally. We don't ask for a response.
Okay. Just sharing.
That's right. And maybe, I don't know, maybe you shouldn't even say it, but it might win more souls and... Mm-hmm. Trying to push us.
Yeah. Right. That right. We can keep that at least at the back of our minds, even if we don't say it, because yeah, that sounds right. Like that's our motivation. Right. I think you're beginning to get, you know, both of you, a good answer to Jenny's question, namely, you know, what are Christians supposed to do? We're supposed to share. And there's, you know, that's not at all excluded from this notion of respecting other people or thinking of them as fellow pilgrims. We're sharing our story with them. You know, you don't hide it. You don't pretend that this isn't important to you because it's part of you.
Mm-hmm. I think on that question that we need to remember that to be Christian is not to be a manipulator.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if we are to do the best evangelism with our own friends and family, mm-hmm. we do it by being faithful
mm-hmm.
and letting God do any converting if that's mm-hmm. enough.
Mm-hmm.
But I was going to raise another one, and that is that we had an experience in one of the churches where I was that we invited a group of students from India, and most of them were Hindu, and among them was a young couple who were more Christ-like than most anyone we had ever known. And we were just sort of stunned by the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it seems to me that there are probably people of all faiths and of no
mm-hmm.
faiths around
mm-hmm.
the world who are more Christ-like than four out of five of us,
mm-hmm.
at least. But I'd be interested in your telling us what we have, what does the Christ spirit have in common with the faith of these other religions?
Mm-hmm.
If we can find the Christ spirit in these other religions,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we emphasize behavior perhaps too much
mm-hmm.
in our religion.
Mm-hmm.
But what is there in these other religions that connects
mm-hmm.
with our understanding of the Christ spirit?
Well, I'm sure that anyone here could give some answers to that. You know, like, what is the Christ spirit?
How do we find it in these other religions?
Okay, well that's another question.
That's an exciting thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you say a little man in our group that we study with, who is very difficult to hear, just in his own way
mm-hmm.
taught me more about the power of the Spirit than I mm-hmm. had learned to that day, and that
mm-hmm.
was quite some time ago.
Mm-hmm.
The man said that, and I knew it, I just needed to have somebody say it that way, that once you start speaking, you're already extending the Spirit of God and the patience that Christians must develop. So that spirit can work. You pray for it, you want it to happen, but it's the spirit that's really going to work in the heart of that person to lead them to God. And no matter how you would force the spirit on someone, that cannot be done, because it's the faith and the power of that power.
Right, it's the spiritual power. And then, partly to respond to your question, I would say, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go looking for the Christ-like figure in these other religions, although I think that's exciting when you find it, like you say, the Hindu who is more Christ-like. But I think more important for us as Christians is to listen to them tell their stories. And maybe at that point the Spirit works so that we can understand in their stories there is something Christ-like. rather than, you know, take our notion of Christ and impose it on Hinduism, and wherever you have a God who sacrifices himself, then there's a Christ-like figure. It may not be, I mean, it may be totally different. But certainly, it still is important for us to recognize in a religion like Hinduism and in Buddhism and in Islam even, that there are what we would call Christ-like elements, whether that is a self-giving love idea or however we want to define the Christ-like elements. And then back to Jenny's basic question. Once again, this notion that I worked with a little bit last week of Christian presence, the basic calling of Christians, according to the New Testament, is to be the presence of Christ in the world. You know, and that's the basis of what is called evangelism, which simply means sharing the gospel, right? The evangel is the gospel. It's the Greek name for gospel. And thus evangelism is sharing the gospel. So being Christ's presence in the world and sharing the gospel is something that we can very well do on this pilgrimage. Right? As we are sharing stories with fellow pilgrims, we are evangelizing. That means, first of all, sharing what we are, right? Sharing our own story, being Christ's presence to them. But as I pointed out last time, and this is where dialogue comes in, I've got to bring that word in at least once before we run out of time. Dialogue means not only sharing my story, but being shared with, right? Dialogue means talking through this barrier between us, but it can't just be a one-way, you know, it's a dialogue. Not a monologue where, you know, I just do all the talking, which is sometimes what evangelism seems to mean to people. But really sharing Christ's presence also means listening. Because you can't be present to someone unless you also listen to that person. If you do all the talking, you're not being present, right? So it's a give and take. It's a sharing and being shared with. And, you know, then if we had a little more time, we could go into a little bit more of a structured way of talking about what dialogue means and how I think that it is, in a sense, what evangelism is. Jenny? Oh, I thought you still had a question with me. Okay.
I was wondering, can dialogue occur with God? Like, it seems to me that to dialogue to occur, we have first to learn from the other people's cultures and, mm-hmm. and their religion. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of Christians, they wanted to, you know, dialogue with other people without really even knowing their story first.
Right, and that's true. We should remember, of course, that while dialogue sounds a pretty formidable word, it can be used on many different levels. There's dialogue between academics. There's a society of Buddhist Christian studies that I belong to, and people get together and read these scholarly papers, you know, from the Buddhist point of view and from the Christian point of view, and we call that dialogue, right? Or more important, I think, is dialogue, you know, on a more neighborly level, like pilgrims. And that would be sharing your stories one with the other. But, you can't really share with someone else and really understand that other person's story without some basic understanding, as you said, of that person's culture and religion and so forth. Let me just very quickly do it kind of like this, terribly oversimplifying the notion of dialogue, but each person's religion is a total system of beliefs and ideas and practices, what we sometimes call symbols, right? It's a whole symbol system that makes up your whole world. For Christians, that would be centered in Christ. It would have ideas of the one God and creation at the beginning of the world and judgment day and sin and salvation and the good ethical life and the Ten Commandments, and all that rolled up together is the way Christians look at the world. You know, that's what makes sense of the world. But over here, this Buddhist has different symbols, right? There, let's say we put the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, at the center,
and ideas of the world cycles and ignorance and clinging is the problem and nirvana is the goal and all sorts of other things, impermanence, that would make up the Buddhist way of looking at the world. Now, when we talk about dialogue, as you're walking on the way with a Buddhist, how do you talk to each other? Well, I think your point is a very good one. We talk to each other, you know, by being interested in each other to begin with, and that means finding out something about